question, and I know I sound about as clear as mud. I wouldn't be sitting here with you guys right now if Nora hadn't lent her strength to me by sharing a personal trauma she had suffered. The table is quiet, all attention focused intently on me. And so I share with them what Nora went through. I tell them every detail she told me. I don't embellish, but I don't hold back. I told them how her life was destroyed in an instant, yet how she managed to not only heal, but also to flourish. "Jesus," Eric mutters, looking at Blue. She has tears in her eyes, and he puts an arm around her. "How crazy is it that Willow is there right now?" Dex murmurs softly. "For that same exact war that tore Nora's family apart." "I'm sure they probably would have a lot to talk about at some point," I surmise. Nora doesn't hold back on that part of her life. She doesn't shy away from the hard stuff.
"Hell of a woman,"
Aaron says with a shake of his head. "The point of me telling you that is so you can hold me accountable," I tell the group, my friends.
"How so?"
Bishop asks, his head tilted and eyebrows furrowed. "Because Nora is sort of the standard for me now," I say. "I've been thinking about this a lot, and I do best when I have goals to accomplish. I've seen what she's done with her life, and it's admirable. She's told me I can flourish, and I want that. But I also know it's not just going to happen because I want it to. It's going to take work and continued effort from me to push for those things. I'm asking you, my first line and the closest allies I have, don't let me fall off task. Don't let me get scared. Push me if you have to. Don't walk on eggshells around me." It's a huge request and a monstrous burden I just put on my teammates, but I wouldn't have asked it if I didn't think they could deliver. I get smiles, some nods, and someone mutters,
"We got your back, man."
Blue pushes out of her chair, rounds the table, and comes up to my chair to bend over and give me a hug.
"We'll help you in any way you need,"
she says, and I pat her forearm awkwardly before giving a harsh glance around the table.
"For the record, no one is allowed to hug me but your female counterparts," I warn my friends. And then I add for clarification, glaring over at my best friend,
"Except your women, Aaron. You're not discriminating enough."
The entire table bursts into laughter, and it's infectious. My mind flits to MJ, and I often like to think she's in a place where she can overlook things from time to time if she so desires. I'd like to think she's watching right now and happy to see what has occurred here.
Chapter 17. Tacker. I come awake slowly, my heart pounding and my skin sweaty. One might think it was a nightmare producing those after effects, but it wasn't. It was a damn sex dream about Nora. I can't remember exact details, so I close my eyes, struggling to go back to where I just was, not wanting to leave the feelings behind. I get only flashes, pieces of a story. Nora under me, our bodies totally melded and writhing. Just a tangle of arms and legs and her breathing. I can clearly remember the way she pants. Clearer than the actual picture of what we were doing are the feelings it produced. Like I was an empty well, and with every stroke inside of her, I was filling up. I can't see her face, don't know the details of her body, but I do know it was Nora. and that she made me feel so many things. As the well filled up, I was scared and yet excited, fucking almost giddy but totally overwhelmed. With her, I felt calm and complete, and yet ready to break apart at any moment. But even the feelings are starting to dull as I become more awake, and it's harder to hold on to it. The feelings eventually fade to black, and I'm left with an empty sensation. The one thing I have apparently brought forth from the dream that doesn't seem to be dwindling is another hard-on. With a sigh, I turn my head on the pillow. I can see my roommate, Bishop, is still sound asleep. The team plane doesn't board until mid-morning, and we were out super late last night at Fleming's. Both of us had intended to sleep in a bit. I roll out of bed, pad across the thick carpet, and head into the bathroom. The last time I dreamed about Nora, I'd also awoken with an erection. Last time, I'd stepped into a cold shower and got rid of my body's betrayal. I don't do that now. Instead, I turn the water on and let it run hot and steamy. Undressing, I consider the implications of what I'm about to do. Damn Dominic Carlson for putting it into my head that Nora could be something more than just my therapist. Damn him all to hell for giving me permission to be attracted to her. And damn Nora for telling me it's okay to move on and making me believe it. Because as I step into the shower, the hot water streaming over my body, and I take my cock in hand, I don't feel an ounce of guilt for what I'm about to do. Bracing my feet apart, I press my forearm against the shower wall and lean into it. I drop my forehead, close my eyes, and start to move my hand. It feels good, but the moment I call forth Nora into my mind, it feels even better, beyond better, and pleasure rips through me. Vivid images fill my mind, calling upon that dream I'd just woken up from moments ago, and perhaps substituting in my own lewd thoughts about her. I wonder about things, like what her skin feels like, silky, I'm sure, and how her kiss would taste, bold and sweet, no doubt. I imagine how it would feel to get lost inside her, and my fist squeezes hard while I stroke. A low groan bubbles in my throat, but I keep it pushed down, not wanting to wake up my roommate beyond the bathroom walls. Faster and faster I move, hips thrusting as I fuck my fist, all the while imagining it's Nora's beautiful body beneath mine. I come unexpectedly, hard and fast, right on the white tile wall as I grit my teeth to prevent myself from crying out how fucking amazing it feels. My chest heaves and my eyes get a little blurry as I lift my head off my forearm. I wait for it, the crushing guilt for betraying MJ. Nothing comes, so I probe a little deeper into my feelings. Exquisite self-loathing for objectifying Nora? My gut tightens, and yeah, I'm feeling a little like a tool. I just fucking masturbated while thinking about my therapist, who went out of her way to share something deep and personal, all to help me move forward. I'm a fucking asshole, but I'm also a man who happens to appreciate how beautiful a woman is. But that's not really making me feel low. In fact, there's no real crushing guilt hitting me at all, and that's fucking disconcerting to say the least. There's only one thing to do. I finish my shower, get a quick shave in, and brush my teeth. Bishop is still asleep when I emerge, so I quietly get dressed. Grabbing my wallet, room key, and phone, I head out to find some coffee and a quiet place to talk. Given that this is Seattle, the coffee will be easy. A quiet place for me to call Nora? Not so much.
Turns out there's a decent coffee shop a few blocks down, but it's overcrowded. I get mine to go, wondering where I can find some solace. It's in the middle of rush hour in downtown Seattle, and the streets are packed with people walking to work. I head back to the hotel. Rather than go inside, I merely lean against the building, right there on the sidewalk, and sip at my coffee. People pass by me without a second glance, in a rush and intent on getting to where they're going. It's then that I realize, despite the flowing crowd of pedestrian commuters, I'm really kind of alone. No one is paying attention to me, and no one is hanging around. I can have a conversation right here on the street, and it'd be more private than if I were sitting in my room with Bishop. I pull out my phone, not concerned with the early hour. Phoenix and Seattle are in the same time zone, and Nora is an early riser. It's something I learned about her just from our counseling sessions when she was telling me a little bit about her workday on the ranch when she wasn't working with clients. She's pretty much a sun-up to sundown kind of woman. Tapping her contact, I listen to the phone ring once, twice, and then it picks up. I'm shocked when Raul answers.
Buenos dias, Thacker.
Hey, I manage to say. Silence ensues as I've completely forgotten why I'm even calling Nora. Raul answering has completely thrown me off.
You okay?
He asks hesitantly.
Yeah,
I reply swiftly, getting a little of my senses back. Just surprised me that you answered Nora's phone.
She walked away for a second,
he says.
We just finished up breakfast and she's off brushing her teeth.
An image of Nora standing at the sink and holding her hair back from her face as she rinses out her mouth hits me. It's vivid and completely conjured from my imagination, not memory. Yet there's something fulfilling about learning that fact about Nora, that she brushes her teeth after breakfast.
You played great last night,
Raul says. I blink, feeling like he just busted me for having intimate thoughts.
What?
I ask, not really understanding what he just said.
Nora and I watched the game last night,
he says, and I can't help the smile that comes to my face.
You looked really good out there.
Thanks, Raul, I reply, feeling like he just paid me the biggest compliment in the world. The fact they watched me together touches me for some reason.
Okay, here she is,
he says. Suddenly, my palms start to sweat as I wait for her voice to come over the line. Busy people walk by quickly, heads down and shoulders hunched. No one cares about my phone call, yet I turn slightly to the side, wanting to protect this conversation.
Thacker?
Nora says, and her voice is a balm.
Hey,
I say, my voice coming out raspy and unsure of itself. I give a slight cough.
Good morning.
Morning,
she replies brightly.
I know Raul just told you, but we watched the game last night. You were wonderful.
It was a good team effort, I say, displacing the praise and redistributing it to my team where it belongs. But not going to lie, it feels good that she watched me.
Are you okay?
She asks, a hint of worry in her tone. She gave me permission to call her as a counselor. In her mind, there would be no other reason for me to call unless I was in distress. And I am, sort of.
I say, not sure how to get this out. Well, I'm having some guilt issues.
The change in her tone is palpable as she enters counselor mode, sounding gently calm yet completely sure of her advice.
Remember, Thacker, when you're feeling that way, I want you to try to focus on the responsible party. It was the plane manufacturer.
No,
I say into the phone, cutting her off. Not about the crash. Oh, she says softly, but not in a surprised way. There are other types of guilt we've discussed in the past. Sorry. Don't apologize, I say gently. But this morning, I'm just feeling, I don't know, a little bad that things are going so well, that I'm doing better and trying to move on. I guess I'm feeling a little guilty that I'm not feeling more guilty. And what I can't tell you is that I'm thinking about you in ways that tell me I'm very much moving on from MJ being the only woman I think about. Nora chuckles, the sound reassuring. I can hear in her amusement that what I'm feeling is actually normal. She even says so.
Tacker, that's good news. It means you're not only healing, but you're also constantly assessing your feelings. You're very aware of the way you used to feel and how different that is from the way you're feeling now. It's probably a little weird for you, I'm sure, but please don't worry about it.
You're sure? I ask dubiously. She asks a question instead.
Why don't you deserve happiness, Tacker? Shouldn't everyone?
I guess, I mutter, scrubbing my hand through my hair. I roll back so I'm leaning against the wall again. But is there a time period on mourning? Something that's acceptable I should be striving for? I mean, timing-wise, is it normal for me to go from utter despair a mere 3 weeks ago to... Words once again drift away.
Happiness? She guesses. Joy in life? Understanding of your feelings?
It's a lot to try to understand. She's quiet for a moment, as she often is when we're in session. Nora likes to process things, and it's not unusual for her to take a moment to collect her thoughts. Finally, she says,
Helen took me from Drenica after the massacre, and I latched onto her. I mean, I fell in love with her right away. Do you think that means I forgot my family?
Of course not, I exclaim, horrified she'd even ask me such a thing.
Do you think by loving Helen that I loved my family any less?
No, I reply, understanding her point. Still, she throws one more.
Even though I loved Helen and I was so grateful to her for giving me a new chance at life, do you think I was done with my sadness and grieving?
I highly doubt it. How could any child get over something like that quickly?
Grief and healing are individual, she says. There's no time period, no book that lays out the rules. I've known some people who need years to process loss in a healthy manner, while others merely take a few months. But if you are stuck worrying about what others think, then you're in the wrong headspace. You only have to worry about what you think.
I'm not worried about what others think, I assure her. I guess I just wanted to make sure that this journey, this new path I'm navigating, I'm doing it right, aren't I?
Yes, Tacker, you're doing it right.
That's all I need. The surety in her words, her conviction and faith in me. Exactly what I needed. Okay. Thanks, Nora. I murmur, pushing off from the wall. I appreciate it.
See you at the ranch on Tuesday, right?
She asks. We'd scheduled my next counseling session for that morning, then I'm off to a team meeting before our game that evening. I'll be there, I assure her. And you and Raul are still coming to the game that night, right?
We wouldn't miss it for the world,
she says with a laugh. Both of you are coming out with the team after, I state.
We wouldn't want to impose.
You're not imposing, I say sternly.
Besides, I think you've sort of been made an honorary team member now that you've helped the inscrutable, assholish Tacker Hall make a comeback. Nora lets out a bark of a laugh, followed by a snort.
Oh, God, that's rich.
But then her laughter dies a little, although I can still hear a bit of amusement in her tone when she says,
And Tacker?
Yeah?
We'll talk about this some more on Tuesday, but be kind to yourself. If you're moving forward, that's a good thing, so don't beat yourself up about it.
Okay, I say. Then I make her and myself a promise I intend to keep. I won't.
Chapter 18. Nora. I've never been to a professional sporting event before. Hell, past football or basketball games in high school, I've never even been to a sporting event. Helen wasn't big into sports, and I had no father figure other than Raul, who was into horses. As such, I was into horses. The Vengeance Arena is a thing of beauty, all steel and glass, with cool little vending shops and restaurants around the exterior. Raul and I came early to grab some dinner. We entered the arena when the doors opened, meandering along the perimeter shops and buying a few small souvenirs. I wanted to buy a Tacker Hall jersey, but they were way too expensive to justify. The energy inside the arena was crazy. I could feel it as it began to fill up, but when we stepped into the interior portion that would lead us down to our seats, it struck me in the center of my chest. Loud rock music plays and laser lights strobe across the ice. The tickets Tacker gave us are extremely good seats, 3 rows off the ice. We made our way down, Raul juggling a beer and popcorn, and me with a foam hand, a pom-pom, and Diet Coke. After we find our seats, we spend the time scanning our surroundings with huge eyes as we take in the spectacle around us. Fans with their faces painted up, and most everyone wearing jerseys to support their team. Crowds gather down at the glass with hand-painted signs. Little kids wait expectantly for their favorite player to make an appearance. And then, an announcer's voice comes over the PA system, booming so loud and deep, I can feel it rumbling in my chest.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the ice your very own Arizona Vengeance.
I swivel my head to the left and right, trying to figure out where the team comes from. But then a gate opens and the team skates through. They hit the ice hard and fast, ready to take down their opponents. I think this is just a warm-up, as they're not wearing their helmets, but I can't be sure. I have just the 2 games I watched on TV last week when Tacker was on the road to go by. Raul nudges me in the arm.
There's Tacker.
I scan the ice, studying the players whizzing by in their white uniforms with neon green and navy blue trim, the Vengeance Lion mascot emblazoned on their chests. And I see him. Holding his stick loosely, he skates around the perimeter with long, powerful strokes of his legs. As he rounds the edge and starts coming our way, his eyes cut into the stands, right to where Raul and I sit. I had not expected this. I mean, of course he knows where our seats are, because they're his tickets. But I'd never expected him to acknowledge us. Not in a million years. Yet his eyes lock with mine, and he smiles, giving me a short nod. It's a brief look, lasting less than 2 seconds, yet it still warms me from my head to my toes. No man's look should ever do that to me, especially not one I'm actively counseling. Face flushing, I take a long sip of my Diet Coke, hoping to cool these thoughts. Tipping my head, I cast a glance at Raul, to find him watching me intently. My face burns even hotter.
Something going on between you two?
He asks gruffly, but I don't detect a single bit of censure, just curiosity. God, no, I assure him quickly, even managing to sound slightly disgusted by the prospect. Raul's gaze just stays pinned on me, refusing to leave. He's not accepting my denial. Averting my eyes, I mutter, "Nothing's going on."
But,
he presses, knowing me all too well. With a sigh, I focus on the man I admire most in the world. But I do like him. I feel a connection to him that goes beyond what I should be feeling as his counselor.
Ethically, you can't go there,
he says gently, a reminder I don't need. I know. I wouldn't. I take a small sip of my Diet Coke through the straw.
But you should,
Raoul firmly states. I'm so shocked by his statement that I suck soda right into my lungs. A massive coughing fit ensues. Shifting his beer from his left to his right hand, he starts clapping me on the back. When I get it under control, I bring wild eyes to him.
How can you even say that?
It's highly inappropriate, not to mention unethical, as you pointed out. Moreover, I could never risk his mental health that way. I have power and sway over him. He trusts me to have a care for his emotional well-being. It would be wrong, wrong, wrong. Raoul inclines his head, attention cutting out to the players skating around.
My bad. Forget I mentioned it.
I will, I snap, then immediately feel bad about it. My gaze moves out to the ice, easily finding Tacker as they set up for some sort of warm-up drill. It's not something you have to worry about. Raoul jerks, swiveling in his seat to face me.
I don't worry about it. I would never worry about you doing anything that would harm one of your clients. You have too good a soul for that, Nora.
Air rushes out of my lungs, my face crumbling into a mask of apology that I would even have to defend myself to a man who has my back no matter what.
All I'm saying,
he continues, as if I truly hadn't said a word about my ethical duties,
is that if you have a real connection to him that transcends the counseling relationship, you shouldn't ignore it.
I open my mouth to say something, but he holds up a hand to silence me.
Whatever you decide to do,
he says softly, putting that hand on my shoulder to squeeze.
Whatever might or might not happen, I trust you to always do right.
I stare at Raoul, not sure what to say to that. But before I can even work through how to respond, a woman comes up beside Raoul's chair on the end of the aisle. She's dressed in a black pantsuit, holding a clipboard with a wireless headset on. Excuse me, she says in a crisp English accent. Mr. Vargas and Miss Wayne?
Si,
Raoul answers. At the same time, I say, yes. I'm Alicia, one of the concierge staff. I understand you two are VIP guests of Mr. Hall, correct? Raoul and I exchange a look. Not sure we're exactly VIP, but Tacker did give us his tickets. She continues without waiting for us to confirm. After the game, I'm going to come and get you. Mr. Hall has arranged for me to give you a tour of the facility while he attends the post-game meeting and showers. I'll then take you to the family room, where you can wait for him. Oh, okay, I say dumbly, thinking it was an incredibly nice gesture for Tacker to make. Also, she says with a smile, Mr. Hall has arranged for you to move to the owner's suite, if you so desire. He got passes for Mr. Carlson today. Food and beverages are served there as well. However, Mr. Hall did want me to pass on that he personally believes these seats are better. He says it's more exciting to watch the game close to the ice. Personally, I have to agree with him. Raoul and I consider each other. When I lift an eyebrow, he shrugs. I give the woman a smile. I think we'll stay here. Thank you, though. She beams. Good choice. Now, unless there's anything else I can get for you right now, I will just meet you back here after the game. We offer our thanks as she turns to leave.
Damn, we're VIP guests,
Raoul says out of the side of his mouth, chest slightly puffed out. He holds his beer up in a silent salute to Tacker, who is concentrating on warm-up drills.
Gracias, amigo.
Laughing, I take another sip of my Diet Coke. Alicia gave us a really cool tour of the arena after the game, which included pretty much everything but the locker room where the guys were showering and dressing. She'd left us in the family room, which I thought was a completely cool and neat concept. It's where close friends and relatives could congregate, both before and after the game, mostly for social camaraderie, as their season ticket seats are often spread out around the arena. There were gourmet hors d'oeuvres as well as an open bar, all paid for by Dominic Carlson. I had been getting the sense from my own interactions with the team's owner, as well as tidbits Tacker told me, that this guy goes above and beyond what other owners do for their teams. In the family room, I see Blue, Brooke, and Reagan congregating together, so we make our way over to the familiar faces. Their smiles are bright and welcoming, and hugs are doled out as well. Since the team had visited the farm week before last, I've stayed in contact with Blue. She even brought Billy out to the ranch one more time. She had also texted me to ask if there were other volunteer opportunities she could do. In fact, she'd been out this past Sunday helping Raul and me fortify some fencing. The girl looks like a California supermodel, but she's not afraid to get her hands dirty or do hard work, which I appreciate. "Where's Pepper?" I ask the girls, noting she's the only one of the first-line women missing. "Home with Charlie," Brooke provides. Tacker told me all about Legend's daughter, Charlie, who had literally appeared on his doorstep last December when the birth mom, who had kept her pregnancy secret from Legend, decided to abandon the baby. Legend had stepped up to the plate big time, and Pepper joined him in helping to raise her. "So, are you two coming out with us tonight?" Blue asks.
"I have to be honest," Raul says, shooting me a tired smirk. "I'm sort of beat after the excitement of that game."
It was exciting indeed. It went into overtime, and the Vengeance won after an exciting breakaway goal by Rafe Simmons. He's the young guy who took Tacker's place on the first line when he'd been suspended. By all accounts, he seems to still be making a profound impact on the team. I give Raul a sympathetic look before telling Blue, "I think we'll pass on going out. We have a hefty drive back to the ranch." Hopefully, I managed to say this while keeping the disappointment out of my voice. I'd actually been looking forward to hanging with Tacker and the team, as my social life has pretty much sucked the last few years after I'd started the ranch. Owning my own business is nothing but 80-hour work weeks, which tends to destroy friendships over time because I never seem to have time to do stuff. Tacker's invitation just hit me in the right spot, particularly after I met so many of the team and their families when they came to help out on the ranch. Raul had said I was becoming part of a new community, and I genuinely liked the feeling that produced.
"You cannot pass on going out with us,"
Tacker's deep voice drawls from behind me. I whirl to see him dressed in a dark blue suit that fits him impeccably. Dumbfounded, I can't seem to recall what I'd just been thinking about.
"I'm way too old and tired to hang out with you young bucks," Raul responds. But then he suggests, "But if you wanted to give Nora a lift, there's no reason she can't go out and have a good time with all of you."
God bless Raul's heart. He knows I want to go out with them, and he's pushing me to do so. "I don't need someone to give me a lift," I tell the group quickly. "I can get an Uber or something to drive me out."
"Nonsense," Tacker replies breezily. "I'll give you a ride."
I'm not sure anyone else catches it, but I do. The slight smirk on Raul's face. I can tell he was angling for that all along. Had been hoping Tacker would be the one to take me home tonight. Not that it means anything to me, because it doesn't. It's just a friendly offer. That's all. Chapter 19. Nora. The waitress comes to our table, her tray stacked with beers. While the food is really good at the Sneaky Saguaro, most people come for the 127 varieties of beer on tap. I'm just a good old-fashioned Bud Light girl, so Wynne first asked what I wanted to drink. That's what I said. Eric felt this was just poor form all around, so he proceeded to educate me on the different types of beers, urging me to try a wheat Hefeweizen. It was delish, so I stuck with that. And I may have had one too many. I enjoy a cold beer or two at the end of the day on occasion, but I've had four tonight, and I'm pretty buzzed. Still, I'm having a great time, without a doubt confirming what I'd expected. The people on the Arizona Vengeance are just fucking awesome. Everyone has made me feel like I'm part of the team. We all hit the sneaky saguaro to a raucous cheer from the patrons when the team walked in en masse. People swarmed some of the players for pictures and autographs, while I noticed many seemed utterly surprised Tacker is there. Even more shocking was the time he took with the fans. I enjoyed watching him interact with them. Granted, he wasn't the most at ease and he didn't engage in a lot of conversation, but he did put on a genuine smile each time a camera came out. I call that amazing progress. The owner of the restaurant has taken to setting up a private area for the team on the second floor. There's a huge two-story cement saguaro that extends up from the first floor and through the middle section of the restaurant to the second. The second floor is a large rectangular section built around the statue, and one whole side was roped off for the Vengeance. The waitress hands me another beer, which I had not ordered. Tacker must see the expression on my face because he leans in.
You don't have to drink it if you don't want to.
I'm in a dilemma, I say honestly. He cocks his head, placing an elbow on the table. We've been at a tall table, the stools having been pushed aside a while ago, along with a lot of the regular tables. Once the kitchen closes at 11, apparently the country music gets cranked, the tables get shoved to the wall, and dancing commences. Tacker has stayed by my side the entire night, but various members of the team and their guests have moved in and out to join our conversation. My throat is actually a little sore from talking, and my head equally so from laughing so much.
What's the dilemma?
He asks. Well, I am enjoying this beer, I say solemnly. But I'm also worried about the hangover effect tomorrow. I feel like I'm at the point now that if I were to decline this and drink water, I'd be able to clean the stalls out tomorrow without a terrible headache or much gagging. Tacker's head tips back as he laughs.
I'd probably advise you not to drink it then.
I hate to be wasteful, but I think you're right, I say, putting the pint glass filled with the amber-orange liquid on the table and pushing it aside. I reach into my purse, nab my wallet, and pull out a $10 bill, which I attempt to hand to Tacker.
What's that for?
He asks, brows furrowed. For the beer you just bought and I'm not going to drink, I say. When we ordered the first round, despite Tacker sticking to water, he'd started a tab and told the waitress to put my drinks on it. I tried to argue with him about it, but he politely told me to zip it.
Are you deliberately trying to piss me off?
He asks. His tone is stern, but I can see amusement sparkling in his eyes.
I mean, perhaps this is some type of therapy whereby you put me in a stressful situation to see how I handle it.
For a moment, I think he's serious, and that hits close to home to think I'd do that. But then his mouth splits into a wide smile, and he shakes his head.
I'm just teasing you, Nora. You and I both know you're not on counselor duty with me when we're out like this, right?
Out like this? I can't help but ask.
As friends, he replies easily.
Yes, of course. Friends. Just as I thought and had hoped for, really. But I try to ignore that little voice in my head that wonders what it would be like to have more with him. I mean, I can't. It's not possible. There's too much to risk and lose on my part. But I can't help the attraction I have to this man. And it's not just physical, although that part certainly doesn't hurt. But the physical is such a small part. The true connection comes from our similar experiences. Because when we engage in our counseling sessions, he and I are both giving and taking of each other, sharing intimate details of grief and pain that are our own little secrets. It's made me feel close to him in a way I don't bond with my other clients. Not a bad thing for my other clients because I give them good attention, advice, and emotional support. I do my job beyond well. But with Tacker, it's just different. And while we've engaged in sharing conversations unlike what I do with my other patients, there's also something else that's not identifiable to me. Which is what makes hanging out with Tacker very risky and quite scary. I like him a little too much, definitely in ways that exceed the boundaries of our professional relationship.
Those look like some heavy thoughts,
Tacker observes, then tacks on a grin.
In fact, I can't even count how many times you've said those same words to me. Looks like I'm the counselor now.
I give a hard shake of my head in denial, because there's no way I'm ever sharing those inner musings with Tacker. Nope, no heavy thoughts. Having a great time. Just then, something bumps Tacker from behind, causing him to knock into me. Not hard, but enough that his full body makes contact with mine, his hands coming to my shoulders to steady me. He whips his head around to glare over his shoulder with an irritated growl. It lands on a few of the rookies who are getting a bit loud and rowdy.
Sorry, Tacker,
one says solicitously, his face awash with fear.
No worries,
he mutters before turning back to me.
Fucking kids.
That's impressive, I drawl, giving a slow hand clap as I grin. Few weeks ago, I do believe you would have punched him.
Few weeks ago, I would have thrown him over the railing and hoped that concrete saguaro didn't break his fall,
he says blandly, and that makes me laugh so hard I double over.
I'd hold up my beer to tap against yours in a cheers type of moment, but I don't want to get drunk and you can't drink, so high five,
I say, holding my hand up with the palm outward. His hand comes out and slaps against mine, then curls around my fingers for a soft squeeze.
We should dance.
I blink, sure I misunderstood him.
Dance?
Yeah, dance,
he repeats.
I've fucking evolved.
Tacker Hall just asked me to dance. A man who, up until a few weeks ago, was a taciturn asshole, hell-bent on closing himself off from the world. The same man who had been so mired in grief, he hadn't known how to smile anymore. A man who had given up on life for all intents and purposes.
Do you know how to dance?
I ask dumbly. Tacker cocks an eyebrow, tightening his hold on my hand and jerking me into him. My hand goes to his shoulder, his other to my waist.
I lived in Dallas for 6 years. I think I know how to pull off a basic two-step.
Well, I say with challenge and, yeah, I admit, a little flirtation. Let's see what you got, cowboy. My head spins as he whirls me around once, then leads me into a two-step. He moves backward, occasionally glancing over his shoulder to make sure he doesn't stumble over another dancer who isn't moving fast enough around the second floor area. There are several others doing a two-step around the perimeter. For a moment, I have to count in my head so I don't stumble. One, one, two. One, one, two. But Tacker is actually an excellent dancer. Without me even needing to ask, I'm going to guess it was something he and MJ did routinely. The mere fact he can get enjoyment from it with someone other than his fiancée is remarkable. And he is enjoying it. He stares down at me, an easy smile on his face.
I'm glad you came out with us tonight.
Me too, I say, with no hesitation. It's nice to make friends.
Tacker's eyebrows draw inward.
You say that like a woman who has no friends.
Oh, I have friends, I assure him. Ones I haven't talked to in weeks or seen in months. Most are now married with kids. I work such long hours that I never get out to see them anymore. Having your own business is no joke.
I can imagine, he murmurs. But you do have a new crew of friends now, and I know a lot were really charmed by the ranch. Consider us all your new crew.
I'm a lucky girl, I murmur, then gasp as Tacker manages to execute a flawless 180-degree spin that puts me moving backward now. Just a few steps, though, then he's spinning me once more to our original positions. You're really good, I say with a laugh. If hockey doesn't pan out, maybe you could rent yourself out at nursing homes and give little old ladies a spin around the dance floor.
Smartass,
he replies affectionately, and we continue to dance. Sometimes his teammates make catcalls at us, all liberally taking the opportunity to tease the man who was such a recluse. He ignores them all. It's a moment we share that's sweet and fun and lighthearted. Until he says something that makes it not so.
MJ didn't want to have kids,
he says out of the blue, causing me to stumble over his foot. Tacker's strong arms right me and we fall back into our gate. I study him a moment, take in his expression. It's not sad or angry. His tone is even and matter-of-fact. It's a statement he would make in counseling. Yet the mere fact he's brought it up while we're dancing in a public place makes it hard to pinpoint exactly what he might be feeling right now. Regardless, it's something on his mind. Perhaps because I had just mentioned my own friends having kids. I don't know if he wants me to be a counselor or friend, but regardless, I give him my undivided attention. Was there a particular reason why? I ask, trying to push him along what is a sensitive topic. Tacker shrugs, his gaze going over my shoulder a moment before coming back to me.
Said she wasn't the motherly type, was scared of childbirth, wanted to concentrate on her career, didn't want to interfere with her time with me, take your pick.
Many women choose not to be mothers, I say.
I know, he replies softly, no judgment against her. But it was a bone of contention with me.
You two fought about it?
He shakes his head. No, nothing like that. Just two polar opposite ideas of what our long-term relationship would entail. I just figured one day she'd change her mind, and I decided to be patient about it.
That can be a huge divide to overcome, especially if it's something you really wanted and she would have never gotten there, I point out.
Guess it's moot now, right?
He says glibly. My voice is gentle and soft, so I step in just a little closer so he can hear me. It is moot now. So why did you bring it up, Tacker? He doesn't answer right away, instead spinning me around once again. When I'm righted, he says,
I've been thinking about things lately, about life without MJ, and what that means going forward. And something that has been on my mind is if I were to have a relationship again, children would be back on the table.
I see, I murmur.
Is that wrong?
He asks,
because I've been struggling hard not to let guilt weigh me down.
It's not wrong, I assure him. You have your whole life ahead of you, and you should lead it without using your past relationship as a measuring stick. To my surprise, Tacker pulls me in extremely close, to the point our torsos are almost touching. Since the two-step is a gate of mutual reliance and we have to be in sync, our legs touch as we move along. He's steady and surprisingly graceful, and I just let myself be carried away by him.
We make the circle around the perimeter two more times, just silently dancing oh so close together. When the music dies, Tacker brings me to a gentle stop. We're in a crowd of people, and the moment has ended. Mutually, we both start to pull away from each other. But it's done in such an incredibly slow manner that there's no denying we're both silently saying, we don't want to let the other go. This is just so wrong on my part. Like that day we hugged in my kitchen on my birthday, my cheek scrapes against his. Then our faces are close as our eyes connect.
It would be so easy to kiss you right now, he murmurs.
And my head absolutely spins with not only the possibility, but also the terrible implications regarding my duty as his counselor.
But we can't, he says,
continuing to draw away until there's a safe distance between us. He looks at me without apology.
It would be wrong.
So wrong, I agree, with utter disappointment in my voice. He hears it. It makes him smile thinly, and disappointment is visible in his expression.
You are about ready to head home?
He asks. Yeah, I reply, not wanting to leave him at all. But I have to.
Chapter 20, Tacker. I found that by wearing a bandana around my face, that horse shit doesn't smell as bad, or rather, it doesn't permeate my nose as well. I'm on the last stall in the gray barn, and I'm proud of myself. When I'd shown up at Sharum Ranch a few hours ago, Nora was in a counseling session in her office. She didn't know I was coming because I'm not on her schedule, but I wasn't overly bothered she wasn't readily available. I'd come to do some volunteer work, deciding to spend some of my free time helping out around the ranch. Besides, I've started to really like Raoul, and I don't want to see him drop dead from overexertion. At least, that's the excuse I've given myself for coming, so I never admit I really came to see Nora, even if it's just a glimpse or a friendly wave of my hand. I'm proud of the work I've done this morning because when I'd found Raoul upon my arrival, he'd put me straight to work having to deal with the horses. While he gladly gave up shoveling shit duty in the stalls to me, he'd informed me that I'd have to lead each horse out on my own because I don't have time to be babysitting you, gringo. I'd snorted and laughed until I realized he wasn't joking. Then I'd reconsidered wanting to help out. Raoul advised me that I'd have to lead the horse out of the stall in order to get in to clean it. That meant I'd have to actually get near the horse, touch it, command it. Not something I was really comfortable with. I can't explain my irrational unease around horses. I'd only been on the one with MJ when we were vacationing. Riding them on the beach seemed romantic to her, but my beast of an animal was huge and skittish around the waves coming in, constantly sidestepping and refusing to obey me. There was nothing fucking romantic about the experience at all. But Raoul showed me what to do. He calmly talked me through how to attach the lead to the halter, then guide the horse out of the stall. There were hooks on the wall with short leads to attach the horse, along with a small hanging trough with hay they could munch on while I worked. I noticed how he murmured Spanish words to the first horse he demonstrated on. The words were irrelevant, but his tone wasn't. He was communicating to the animal, letting the horse know he cared for it and respected it. The horse followed his every command, and it gave me a little bit of confidence. I'd managed to handle all five stalls on the one side, easily transferring each horse back and forth. By the time I got to the last one, I was thinking that perhaps I could be friends with these beasts.
Good work, mijo,
Raoul says from behind me.
After I finish sprinkling the last bit of fresh hay, I dust my hands off on the back of my jeans. I don't even spare Raoul a glance as I move out of the stall and over to the horse genially waiting for me to be done with his home. Murmuring soft words under my breath, I run my hand along the brown fur on his back as I approach. Unclipping his rope from the hook, I lead the horse back into the stall, even guiding him around in a three-quarter circle so his head is facing the door. I do this mostly because I don't want to be near his back end as I'm leaving, but when my eyes catch Raoul as I ease out, his are filled with what I might even call a bit of pride.
"Getting over your fear,"
he says with an appreciative nod. While I hate to admit I'm afraid of anything, I have to accept his words as true. I was scared of the damn things, but I'm getting more used to them. Glancing down at my watch, I say, "I've got a few more hours before I have to get back. What else you got for me to do?" We've actually got the day off today. Our next game is at home and not for two more days, so Coach told us to take a day of rest. He'd probably freak out if he knew I was here doing manual labor on a ranch with a freshly healed, fractured wrist. The cast actually comes off tomorrow, and I can't fucking wait. But I do have dinner plans with Aaron tonight. Nothing fancy, but a good opportunity to continue reconnecting with my best friend. I feel like I have amends that still need to be made for pushing him away after the crash.
"I've got nothing but beer to offer you," Raoul says with a smile.
Gonna have to pass on that, I say with a chuckle. He knows I can't drink. But I wouldn't say no to a bottle of water. Raoul shuffles down the center aisle of the barn, and I follow. There's a small room at the end. Inside it is a small desk, mini fridge, and two chairs. A window unit air conditioner chugs away, cooling the interior.
"Welcome to my office," Raoul says with a dramatic wave.
I step in and glance around. There's nothing on the desk. No computer, no papers, nothing.
"What do you need an office for?"
Raoul shrugs.
"No clue. Nora outfitted the desk and fridge for me, tried to buy me a computer, but I hate the damn things and threatened to quit if she did. So I basically just come in here to cool off and enjoy a beer once in a blue moon when it gets too hot."
"That's legit," I reply, making myself at home and walking over to the fridge. It's stocked with beer, water, Swedish fish, and a lonely-looking apple. I nab a beer and water, closing the door with a bump of my leg. Raoul lowers himself into one of the chairs with a slight wince, and I wonder what part of him is hurting. I imagine at his age, while working on a ranch and doing physical labor, probably more than one part of his body is aching.
"You played really well last night,"
Raoul says, accepting the beer I hand to him before I sink into the other chair.
"Even with that damn thing on your wrist.
Can't wait to get it off." I open the water bottle, then take a long pull.
"You looked light on your feet. Confident, too."
A smile plays at my mouth. I feel about 1,000,000 pounds lighter these days. Guess that translates out on the ice, too.
"Glad to hear it,"
he replies, holding his beer up in a silent toast. There's something comforting about sitting in this old barn office with the air conditioner rattling. Raoul sips at his beer, watching me with wizened eyes. I don't feel like I have to have my guard up with him, and I wonder why that is. I know part of it is because I've worked hard to lower my walls, but there's more to it.
"It's all because of Nora,"
I say, wondering why I'm in such a sharing mood. Raoul nods, a fond expression on his face.
"That girl is special. Knew it the moment I gave her first riding lesson."
"How old was she?" I ask.
"About 12, as I remember,"
he replies gruffly.
Helen brought her out, explained a little bit about her background to me. Nora spoke English because the European countries all teach it, but because she'd grown up in such a rural area, she hadn't had a lot of practice with it. The communication was a little hard at first. You could see she'd experienced something horrible because she had that shy, wounded look about her. But you could also see that deep in her eyes, there was determination. I try to imagine her back then, maybe that dark hair and pigtails and struggling with the language a bit, suffering unimaginable grief and trying to acclimate to a new country and home, then stepping up to a big horse, determined to master it. Yeah, Nora special.
She's the hardest working person I've ever known,
Raoul continues, by his tone a little lost in fond memories. She was so determined to become an American. She wanted to speak fluently by the time her adoption with Helen became finalized, so every time we had a riding lesson, she would chatter the whole time, forcing me to talk with her so she could practice. I chuckle, figuring it probably hadn't taken long for Nora to worm her way into Raoul's heart. I know he considers her to be like a daughter. What about your family? I ask. Raoul takes a long pull from his bottle, his eyes falling a little flat.
My wife, Guadalupe, died 9 years ago. Our kids moved east years ago, though. Got a handful of grandkids I don't see all that often because they never come back to visit. Sad to say, Nora's more like a daughter to me than my own.
You're lucky to have her. I lower my gaze, becoming reflective. Hell, I'm lucky to have her. Raoul's eyebrows shoot up in surprise.
You know, as my therapist.
I quickly correct.
Didn't sound like you were thinking of her like a therapist,
he replies with challenge, but not in an offended way. He almost sounds fucking delighted by it. I furrow my brow, wondering what's on his agenda. Is he being overprotective? Do I need to start some major backpedaling? I wanted to kiss Nora last night, I blurt out, then have to restrain myself not to clap my hand over my mouth in shock that I just admitted that to this man who may as well be Nora's father.
Say what?
Raoul asks with rounded eyes.
We were dancing and talking and, well,
I wanted to, but I didn't. I know we can't.
She has ethical guidelines, Thacker,
Raoul says quietly, and I'm slightly mollified by the empathy in his voice.
Her license is at stake. You don't have those things holding you back.
I know. The frustration is heavy in my voice, and I have no business thinking about her like that. I fucking lost my fiancée in a plane crash. I've been in such deep grief and guilt over